I'm Christopher Lighton. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation, we call it, with global attitude. This one's about Darfur, with a man who is saying that almost everything we were told to think and feel and do about the slaughter, some said genocide, in the western province of Africa's largest country, Sudan, was wrong. Wrong facts, wrong judgment, wrong advice. I am one of those who absorbed, probably much too easily, the big picture story of Arabs killing Africans in Darfur, the feel-good notion that a merciful intervention in Darfur would be a good guy opposite of the war in Iraq, and the idea that the rest of the world had to do something. My guest, Mahmoud Mamdani, born in Uganda with Indian family roots, is a scholar who felt all along that there was something fishy in the details and the thinking behind that story. And he kept going back to Darfur to sort out his suspicions and the real history of the place. His book on Darfur, Politics, and the War on Terror is titled Saviors and Survivors. Our conversation is, among other things, a picture of an anthropological mind at work, looking for the unwritten rules, the unseen implications of what was happening in Darfur, and also in our own American response. Mahmoud Mamdani, I'm so happy to meet you finally. I've read your articles in the London Review of Books for years, and now your book on Darfur, trying to work my head around your very pointed angle on it. I should fess up at the start, I represent, in a certain sense, your problem. I'm a media dude in America. I read and I sometimes interview Nicholas Kristof of The Times, and bought into a lot of that big framework that Darfur was all about Arabs slaughtering Africans and that somebody had to do something about it. Straighten me out.
Well, if you represent my problem, then I think you also represent my solution, or my way to the solution. Because if you've interviewed Nicholas Kristof, if you've interviewed Eric Reeves, then you have participated in shaping, to some extent, that audience, which is the constituency of Save Darfur, and I need to get to that audience because I need to turn what has been a sermon into a debate and a discussion. I need to sow some seeds of doubt about what have been presumed to be simply goodwill gestures. I need to convince that audience that there's a politics around this, not simply a good intentions and moralism and a fight against evil. I need to tell them that there is no such thing as a trans-historical evil in the world in which we live. Mm. That, in fact, all violence, without exception, has causes, and the causes are historical. And if we want to do something about the violence, we need to do something about the causes. The idea that violence is its own explanation is an idea which will take us nowhere except in just a cycle of violence.
Listen, I'm all ears, especially on the general point that for millions and millions of Americans who think they feel something about Darfur, we know almost nothing about the place, the people, the history. Would you just introduce yourself a little bit and your method? Reading your book, you seem to have been at 1,000 meetings of the parties, not only read the history, but sort of heard it on the ground. Who are you, and what is the approach? Are you a self-made anthropologist of East Africa, or what?
Well, Christopher, I am just like you, in that I have more questions than answers. Mm-hmm. When I went to the Save Darfur site, I was perplexed by this documentation of atrocities, endless documentation of atrocities, people killed, villages burned, women raped, people driven out of their homes, with the naming and shaming of perpetrators and victims, but no attempt to explain why this was happening, no attempt to trace its history, its causes, even when it was happening. I felt an assault on my senses, almost like a pornography of violence. No context at all. And I wondered what this was about. I wondered what was the politics of this kind of presentation of a problem by completely detaching it from its context. And I realized that this was a politics which took its coordinates from a different context, not from the history of Darfur, not from the context of Darfur and Sudan and that region, but from the context of the war on terror. This is a claim that there exists evil, that perpetrators will always be perpetrators, victims will always be victims, and that does not make any sense of Darfur for us. It cannot make any sense of the world we live in, where yesterday's victims may become tomorrow's perpetrators, and yesterday's perpetrators tomorrow's victims. A world where violence is not its own explanation, where unless we address the causes of violence, we will simply end up reproducing the violence.
This book, as well as being a history of Darfur and the Sudan, is a kind of anthropology of us and media and the American mind and the American mindset. It's solidified around Iraq. It's going to affect our path toward Afghanistan in the future, I think. But in Darfur, as you write, we love to stamp places and people that we barely know with racial labels, religious labels, scariest of all, Islamic and Islamist labels, and then moral labels. We, as you say, we stalk the world to find evil, axes of evil, distillations of evil, as in Darfur. But it's a very selective and curious search, as you say. What is it about us in this story? And is there a cure for it?
I sure hope there's a cure for it. All of us must hope there's a cure for it. I think what underlines this kind of approach is the assumption that wherever you go, Darfur, Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Gaza, wherever you go, the assumption is that the problem is always internal and the solution is always external. It's kind of a secularized 19th century missionary approach.
Meaning what?
Meaning you are the problem, we are the solution. The solution comes from outside, the problem is internally generated. It translates into philanthropy, it translates into conversion, it's always blaming the victim. If, on the other hand, you begin to say yourself that the violence, no matter how relentless, is always issue-driven. It's never mindless. It's always issue-driven. Then you have to address the issues. And once you address the issues, you realize that there is no such simple dichotomy like problems are internal and solutions are external, but you find internal and external faces of both problems and solutions. So when I began to work on Darfur, my first interest was simply in trying to understand the history of this development. I realized, reading, talking, that somehow there was something new that happened in the mid-80s. That before the mid-80s, conflicts in Darfur were there. There were conflicts between neighbors. There were border conflicts. And they were usually settled by reconciliation meetings and conferences.
You say, you write in the book that they have a gift for reconciliation and kind of a structure, long history of it.
Yeah, they have a gift for reconciliation. They have a long history of settling disputes. They have a long, they have a deep understanding that disputes are inevitable. They're about borderline. They're about different ways of life coming together. And therefore, their way of addressing disputes is not only to have reconciliation when disputes emerge, but to act before disputes emerge. They constantly intermarry. They constantly ensure that each is present inside the community of the other, so that there's no clear division between us and them. So intermarriage is a way of life in Darfur. But what I also understood is that beginning the mid-80s, a new kind of conflict emerged, which was just sort of qualitatively different. It was qualitatively different in terms of the scale of violence, the level of brutality, the assumption that we can't live together. Either I live or you live. And observers noted that, and I sort of wondered where this came from.
Now, you're talking East Africa or the world or the zeitgeist?
No, I'm talking of Darfur. Ah. I'm talking of Darfur. Darfur. 1980, this conflict has its history, and the first phase of that history is 1987-89. And like any sort of complex phenomenon, it has multiple causes. And as I began to explore these causes, I realized that there was a deep cause, which lay in the way Britain redesigned that part of the world when it came to control it in the early 20th century. You know, before Britain came to control it, there was a sultanate in Darfur. For several centuries, Britain took this real estate, Darfur, this province of Darfur, and divided it into tribal homelands. In the sultanate, the king used to give out parcels of land to notables, and the effect was to create individual property alongside communal property. Britain abolished all individual property, created only communal property, tribal homelands. But then it also brought this other principle in, which is that the future should belong to settled peoples, not to people who move around, not to nomads, that the nomadic way of life is immune to civilization, it's immune to property except whatever moves on four legs. And so it created homelands for peasant tribes. It created smaller homelands for cattle nomads, because they have villages, and half the time they live in those villages, and the other half they move around. But it gave no homelands to camel nomads, because they're moving all the year round. They have no villages. They just, whatever they have, they carry on their camel. They move on.
Would you argue that it was the Brits who racialized the population? You quote Winston Churchill at some length on this very hard imperial categorization of the African type and the Arab type. Is that when that began or not?
Well, the Brits introduce a new technology of governing people, right? When they capture real estate, they come and they value it. They do geological surveys of what exists above the ground, what exists below the ground, and they also classify the people who live above the ground. And when they classify them, they have to decide the categories in which they will plug each person and each family, and these are the categories by which they will rule them. So the central category was race. If you look at the census, the Brits carried out a census of Sudan 1954-55, but they began preparing for that census in the early 20s. And the key administrator, McMichael, wrote a whole series of articles on and so the census was organized around three categories: tribe, groups of tribes, and race. And tribe was the administrative division on the ground. They call it tribe. Groups of tribes were those administrative divisions which spoke the same language. So it was a cultural category. But race was kind of out of the British mind completely. It had very little to do with the reality on the ground. And the British mind, or the 19th century imperial mind, created a sort of way of understanding world history as a history of races. So that Sudan, northern Sudan, this part of the world with a 6,000-year-long recorded history, one of the longest in the world, in the British mind, was a place where these 6,000 years were the result of successive influences from the outside, not developments from the inside. Mm. So Pharaonic, Byzantine Christian, Arab Islamic, British Western, that's how they viewed it. Only in their writing of history of the West did developments take place as a result of internal changes. The rest of the world, they understood as a result of externally introduced changes. Mm. So, in Darfur, in every tribal homeland, they divided between two races. Those they considered natives, and those they considered settlers. And the settlers were those who they designated as the Arab race. I say Arab race because one curious thing about it is that they didn't just name as Arab all those who spoke Arabic as their mother tongue. Because if you look at the census, over 50% in Darfur and in Sudan speak Arabic as a mother tongue in their home. But those designated as Arab race are about 33%. So it's only some of those who speak Arabic as a mother tongue are considered Arabs racially. Well, that was the deep background. Then there was a more immediate background, which is more ecological. Over 40 years, the Sahara moves 100 kilometers south, pushing these camel nomads of northern Darfur south, as the boundary of the desert goes down south. It pushes these people south. They move south looking for land on which they can graze, and they head for the best land, lush mountain terrain, central Darfur, Jabal Mara, 70 kilometers of mountain range. Mm. And there begins a classical conflict between peasant and pastoralist tribes over who would control this land. There's a third cause. which is when the drought reaches its climax in the middle 80s, there's a civil war also reaching its climax in Chad, which is neighboring to Darfur. And this civil war is now incorporated in the Cold War because Reagan has come to power. Reagan, the Reagan administration, with France and Israel, are supporting one side in the civil war and the other side in the civil war being supported by Gaddafi, Libya, and the Soviet Union. Darfur becomes the backyard to this civil war. The government is in power in N'Djamena, in Chad. The opposition trains in Darfur, organizes in Darfur, arms in Darfur, attacks from Darfur. By the mid-80s, when there's no water in Darfur, the place is awash with guns. Mm. Right. And so the scale of the level of technology is going up. These Kalashnikovs and AK-47s, the scale of violence is becoming intense. The level of brutalities is becoming intense. And you have this civil war, which begins in 1987. Darfur becomes like Eastern Congo, Kivu. The way Kivu and Eastern Congo is to Rwanda, Darfur is to Chad. So whoever is in the out of power in Rwanda goes to Eastern Congo. They train there. In 40, 50 years, Eastern Congo is militarized. Same. Darfur gets militarized.
Mm. And then what happens in the 21st century, 2002, 3, 4, it becomes suddenly big news in America.
Yeah. It becomes big news partly. The civil war.
I should say it becomes bigger news than the Congo, not bigger news than the war in Iraq, but it's almost on that scale.
Well, first, let me just trace what changes happened in Darfur itself. In 1989, the present government comes into power in Khartoum, the Islamist government. When it comes into power, one of the complaints it has against the guys it overthrows is that they didn't give enough attention to Darfur. So both sides in the civil war say, okay, now the government is going to come in. So there's a reconciliation conference. It's settled. The government comes in, it's unable to solve the main problem, land. Because it says, okay, the problem is that the camel tribes don't have land, don't have a homeland. So what we're going to do is we're going to create a homeland for them by taking some of the land away from the peasant tribes, which restarts the civil war. That's in the middle of the 90s. 2003, another thing happens, which is that this intermittent civil war, which has been waged by tribal militias, some of the tribal militias have begin to develop a broader understanding of the world by linking up with other forces in the world. One militia links up with the SPLA, the Sudan People's Liberation Army, in South Sudan. It develops, now it becomes a rebel movement, SLA, Sudan Liberation Army. The other militia develops a link with Islamists in Khartoum, the Islamist opposition in Khartoum, the Islamists who are out of power. And it develops this rebel movement called JEM, Justice and Equality Movement. These are the two main rebel movements in Darfur. The government itself, faced with these two rebel movements, launches a counterinsurgency. In a way, the government takes its cue from the global war on terror, which is stomp out violence with violence. If you faced with violence, you counter with violence, except yours is good violence against bad violence. And Bush, the Bashir and his government carry out their own little war on terror in Darfur. So there are real brutalities, real atrocities, 2003-2004. The atrocities, one of the good things that Save Darfur movement does is it publicizes these atrocities. And the Bashir government retreats. The African Union steps in. That's the second reason the Bashir government retreats. From the end of 2004, the level of atrocities and the level of violence is really low. Every report I have seen from January 2005 on, the numbers of civilians who died in Darfur were less than an average of 200 per month. 2008, 2 weeks ago, I heard the commander of the UN forces. He was invited to Addis Ababa to give a presentation to the African Union panel headed by Thabo Mbeki. In his presentation, he said 1,500 civilians were killed, roughly, in the whole year 2008. Out of these, roughly 600 died as a result of fighting between different Arab tribes over grazing land, and roughly 900 died in fighting between the government and the rebel movements. Even if put together, this is less than 150, average of 150 dying a month, less than die in Washington, D.C. from violence. So the question that interested me was why Save Darfur was completely uninterested in this change, this reduction in the level of violence from early 2005, this great opportunity to settle the problem politically. Instead, they were demanding a military solution of the problem. They were demanding a no-fly zone. They were demanding people going in from outside. The more research I did, I realized that even their numbers, by the scale of violence, the number of people dead, were so inflated that this had been pointed out by an agency of the U.S. government, Government Accountability Office, in 2006, and yet it had no effect on Save Darfur. But even more astounding was that just when the Save Darfur hype was getting more and more removed from the reality on the ground in Darfur, its mobilization on the ground in the U.S. was more and more successful. And I kept asking myself, why? Why were people getting involved without asking whether what they were being told about Darfur was true or not? Eventually,
it's very curious. And I would just say it did have a life of its own in a kind of contrary parallel with the war in Iraq, which was going very badly by then. But already the Save Darfur movement had become a kind of good guys war on terror, a feel-good case for another intervention. I mean, how far can you play out that almost musical theme in inversion that was going on between these two, the Bush war in Iraq and something else being done psychologically in Darfur, in the campaign? Yeah.
Well, you know, for me, actually, it was a puzzle. Because I lived 9 months of the year in New York City. And I could see a high school kids, college kids, very involved in this mobilization around Darfur. And I couldn't see any mobilization around Iraq. And yet I knew there were U.S. soldiers in Iraq. There were no U.S. soldiers in Darfur. And how come American citizens were mobilizing around Darfur and not around Iraq? My friends would tell me, oh, you know, there used to be a draft during the Vietnam War. There's no draft now, so there's no mobilization around Iraq. But it didn't explain the mobilization around Darfur. And I realized that when my students, for example, thought of Iraq, they had no choice. They thought they had to think of it as American citizens, because Iraq confronted them as responsibility of a citizen. Should we be in Iraq? Should we not? If we leave Iraq, what will happen? Will the Sunnis kill the Shia, kill the Kurds? They had to think politically. They had to, no matter how superficially, they still had to think of the history of Iraq, Iraq as a place in the world. Darfur was different. They didn't think of Darfur as citizens. They thought of Darfur as humans. They had no interest in the history of Darfur, save Darfur was not interested in telling them about the history of Darfur. They had no interest in the issues that created the violence, and Save Darfur wasn't going to tell them about it. All they were interested in was Darfur was a site of evil. That's where evil lived. Mm. That's where atrocities happened. That's where there was a perpetrator, Arab. And that's where there were victims, African. So Darfur, I used to think about, you know, I recalled, actually, that when I first came to the U.S., I remember being so amazed, so impressed with the generosity of Americans, how they gave to charities, and with how stingy they were about paying taxes. You know, this contrast constantly puzzled me. And, you know, Iraq was a tax, and Darfur is a charity. Mm. And that's the difference to me, because Iraq makes Americans feel guilty or own up to the limits of American power. In Darfur, however, they can feel philanthropic. They're doing good. It's, as you say, it's a feel-good politics.
And by then, it's all in your book, but there was this incredible parade of celebrities. I mean, how could Al Sharpton and Elie Wiesel and Seamus Heaney and the U.S. Conference of Bishops in the Catholic Church, Nat Hentoff, Bob Geldof, Harold Pinter, Angelina Jolie, I mean, you name them, how could they all be wrong?
Yeah, and they could all feel at the same time together powerful saviors. Those who would be unable to stand together on Iraq felt very comfortable on Darfur as saviors.
I just want to remember that Darfur is not, in a sense, the only Darfur in the world, or potential Darfur. I want to be sure we talk about other places of which, in a sense, Darfur is an example, maybe a warning.
Well, you see, the attractive thing about Darfur is that there is no direct U.S. involvement. There's no direct involvement of official America. To a population which is tired of the consequences of official American involvements in the world, Darfur suddenly appears as a place which is untainted, seemingly untainted, by official American involvement, and yet there's violence because the perpetrators are Arabs. And what Save Darfur tells them is that these are Arabs who came from the Middle East. They're outsiders. They're outsiders who came in and they are oppressing insiders, natives, Africans. And the constituency of Save Darfur takes this without recognizing the more than a pinch of salt in it. Because the fact is that these Arabs didn't come from outside. That these Arabs are as much of insiders. And that, in fact, there is no single Arab group in Sudan. There are many Arab groups, each with their own different history, So that if you go to Central Sudan, not northern, sort of around the Nile, you will find a history of the Funj Sultanate from around the 16th, early 16th century. And you'll find that every kingdom in that period, from Ethiopia to Senegal, the royalty claimed descent from the Holy Land. Mm. The Ethiopian kings claimed kinship with King Solomon. And the others claimed to have descended from the house of the Holy Prophet. The Arabs of Darfur are completely different. The Arabs of Darfur, unlike the Arabs of the Nile Valley, they're not privileged. They're not in power. They're in fact the poorest of the poor. They are the most wretched of the Darfuri population. Unlike the Arabs of the Nile Valley are settled farmers, these are nomads who from time immemorial have moved along the southern rim of the Sahara, between the southern rim of the Sahara and the rain belt of the equator, so that you don't have the tsetse fly. It's along that region that they have moved, along with no borders. If you become a nomad, you get cattle or you get camels, you become a nomad, you become an Arab. And if you join the community, you learn by rote the entire tree, you know, like the Old Testament.
The begets.
Yes, the begets. This, beget that, beget that, beget that, beget that. You learn it, you memorize it. Except that, you know, they're, for the camel Arabs, there are only 15 to 18 generations between now and Prophet Muhammad. You know, the rest is just vanished. So it's only the only real stuff is the first four or five generations. You, your father, grandfather, great-grandfather, and his father. And then the Prophet,
and a
his,
long leap to
his
the
son.
Prophet.
And in the middle is nothing. It's just... But, well, human beings have constructed, invented, thought their past. They've made up their past. They've, you know, every generation rethinks its past in a way. It's an African tradition. Every African tribe has claimed to have had connection with God in some way, you know. A holy kind of origin. So the Save Darfur, sort of this idea that there were Arabs who came from outside and who lording it over Africans on the inside, this is really a contemporary version of the British history of the 19th century and early 20th century. So it was just, it's a part of the recipe of demonizing particular groups. And making other groups appear as nothing but victims.
Mahmoud Bamdani, I'd love to hear you project the Darfur pattern forward in a way, and specifically to Afghanistan, where it's not quite clear what President Obama wants to do. The pattern specifically of not knowing much about local politics, a moralism in our view, a kind of CNN wallpaper picture effect. How should it caution us about our approach to Afghanistan, which also, of course, comes out of the British imperial history?
Well, you know, look, the Obama administration's message right now is a mixed message. The positive side of that message is... a realization that this conflict cannot be settled militarily, that it must have a political resolution, that if it is to have a political resolution, you can't just think of the Taliban as bad guys you must actually begin to think of which sections of the Taliban you could live with, and you must accommodate. In other words, the solution can't just be external. To be durable, the solution must have an internal component in it. So these are all positive signs. But the really negative signs are in Pakistan. Because there you have a war being fought by drones operated from, I don't know, somewhere in Tennessee or Mississippi or...
Tampa, maybe.
Maybe Tampa, Florida. Just sort of video games and drones killing people. Because if you look at a place like the Swat Valley, where presumably the population is sandwiched between the Pakistani Taliban and the drones, at least the Pakistani Taliban are on the ground. You can join them. You know, if you want to save your family, maybe you join the Pakistani Taliban, so you save your family. How do you join the drones? The drones just come from the sky and they kill. It's a completely imbalance. So there is no politics. So, you know, there is of course the other message of the Obama administration in Pakistan, which is, oh, we made a mistake by giving military aid all this time to a military dictator, and maybe we should give non-military aid, but then the drones are still there, because the drones are coming directly, you know, coming through the government. So it's a mixed message. It's contradictory. So the relevance here is that, look, sooner or later one would have to recognize these are political problems. They are political problems that, in the main, the solution has to be internal. It cannot be external. That there is no alternative to developing friendships on the ground, and to develop friendships, you have to acknowledge people's right to live. Sort of the old adage of live and let live, in a way. But I think we're in the early phases of the administration. A lot of learning will have to happen. A lot of learning will take place. I mean, look at it. America took 8 years to reverse the results of a stolen election of 2000. The price paid by the world to give America 8 years has been a huge price. I mean, it's the war on terror. How many have died? Darfur is pittance.
Come back to Darfur for a minute. Since you finished your book, the president of Sudan has been indicted by the International Criminal Court. The International Criminal Court, which President Bush took the United States out of, practically. How does the al-Bashir indictment clarify the question of outside judgment and the themes of your book?
Look, first, one needs clarity on exactly what the International Criminal Court has said. Because this is not a trial and a verdict. This was a pre-trial and a summons. In other words, what it has said is, given the facts as presented by the prosecutor, the judges said, if the facts were true, is there a case to answer? And they said, yes, there would be a case to answer. Not genocide, but crimes against humanity. Now, the facts are not yet on trial. The facts would be on trial once the trial got going. Now, the facts as presented have all the exaggerations that I talked about earlier. They talk of no history. They don't talk of the fact that the civil war began even before Bashir came into power, 1987-89. They presume that the level of violence continued and has continued, whereas in fact it fell down dramatically from January 2005. But that's one. But there's a more serious thing there. The more serious thing is the presumption that the way to move forward is through criminal indictments. Because I think actually that is the way to restart the war.
Really?
Yes. Because look, Africa has had an experience now of about 20 years of how do you deal with problems, with conflicts, which are unresolved, which are continuing conflicts, where there's no victor, no vanquished. Both sides are still fighting. And this experience begins with the end of apartheid. How do you bring to a close of apartheid when the struggle against apartheid has not been victorious? And the lesson of that was that you have to prioritize politics, political reform. Because the very people, if you prioritize criminal justice, the very people you would take to jail are the very people you need to implement a political reform. So there's a clear choice. Which way do you go? Do you put de Klerk in jail, or do you convince de Klerk that, okay, the past is past, let's agree to a different future, a reformed polity? And that's what they did in South Africa. That's what they did in Mozambique with Renamo, these guys who used to capture kids, kidnap kids, and just like in northern Uganda or in Sierra Leone, kidnap kids. And these kids who are victims are then turned into perpetrators, right? Because they in turn inflict torture on others. So what do? Do you take them to jail, court and jail, or instead they're sitting in parliament, but the fighting has come to an end?
This is a big theme in the end of your book, the difference between roughly the Nuremberg trial model and the peace and reconciliation, truth and reconciliation model in South Africa, or between, it's the difference between the African Union and the United Nations intervening. It's the difference between what you call victor's justice and survivor's justice. Spell that out.
Well, you know, victor's justice, Nuremberg, is a model where the assumption is that those who've come out of yesterday's conflict cannot possibly live together. The survivors must have another country and another future. They must have an Israel. Right? That's the presumption. The African reality is totally different. Hutu and Tutsi must have to live together. They have no choice. They belong to the same country. Blacks and whites have no choice. They have to live together in South Africa. The living cannot afford to continue with the battles of the past. They must bury the hatchet. And how do they do it? They must reform the polity. They must reform the polity. They must give up the idea of the best solution. They must reach out for the second best. The second best. If the best solution is Israel, The second best solution is to continue to live together with your worst fears, which is your neighbor.
Can you imagine a restored polity in Darfur? What would a truly local or regional just solution to that conflict look like?
Well, the toughest problem in Darfur is the problem which would not be solved if Darfur became independent, because it's the problem of land. Mm. It is the problem of how do peasants and nomads live together in a country which had been parceled into tribal homelands. You would have to find a different way of relating people and their rights to land and the resources on the land. That's it. That's a real challenge that the Darfuris face. The question of how to live as part of Sudan is easier, because the way is the way forward is shown by the agreement in South Sudan, which is not different from the agreement in Mozambique, which is not different from the agreement in South Africa, which is change the rules for the future. We'll forget the past if the rules are changed for the future. If the polity is reformed, you can have rule of law. And if you have rule of law, you have accountability. The third problem with this ICC thing is that, see, the discussion on accountability somehow seems to presume that the problem is only how do you hold perpetrators accountable. But there's a bigger problem. You don't just need to hold perpetrators accountable. You need to hold the enforcers of justice accountable. How do you hold the sheriff accountable? Mm. Not just the the cowboy, but how do you hold the sheriff accountable? Because if you don't hold the sheriff accountable, then it will just be a private agenda masquerading as public justice. So this prosecutor, who is he accountable to? He is accountable minimally to the Security Council, which can refer and defer cases. The Indian government refused to sign the Rome Convention because it said that this prosecutor has an accountability to the Security Council, which means he will never take members of the Security Council to court. But that's a minimal accountability. Otherwise, this prosecutor is not accountable to anybody. Hmm. So he's available on the market to be captured by whoever is the strongest. Apparently, right now, it seems to me he's captured by Save Darfur and the forces around Save Darfur. You know, the U.S. has an experience of rogue prosecutors, right? Remember the guy who took the Clintons to town, man? You know, nobody could hold him accountable. This is a rogue prosecutor, it seems to me. You know, to be fair to Ocampo, Ocampo has a real problem, which is he's the first prosecutor of this completely new institution, which the U.S. had boycotted, refused to join, and the U.S. was running around signing bilateral agreements with every country in the world to say that we will not turn over your nationals to the ICC. And
you won't turn over ours.
Yeah, and you won't turn over ours. And this prosecutor finally figured out that, okay, if he could signal to the U.S. that I will not take you to court, and I will not take your friends to court, but I will only take to court those people whom you don't like, like al-Bashir. So the U.S. said, okay, we won't stand in your way. You go ahead. So this is a kind of a rapprochement being worked out between power and this guy with his job. Unfortunately, its consequences are for all of us to pay for.
What effect will it have on the alliances around save Darfur, that wouldn't want the ICC prosecuting Israel in Gaza, for example, or the U.S. in Iraq?
The U.S. in Iraq, or the U.S. in Afghanistan, or the U.S. The drones in Pakistan, or Israel in Gaza, or in the West Bank, or anywhere else. Well, there is no, apparently, none of these parties seem to be afraid anymore of such prosecution. The prosecutor of the ICC has cut his cloth to suit his size. Actually, as he won't even go near parts of the world who are neighbors of China or India. So every case is in Africa. Only prosecute in Africa. They say now that ICC is a Western court for African villains. It's the new thing that they've got.
Is selective justice better than no justice?
Selective justice is no justice.
Mahmoud Mamdani, it's a pleasure to meet you and to hear you out, not only on Darfur, but on all its vibrations around the world. We're going to continue this conversation. Thank you.
Thank you, Christopher. Thanks for having me.
Sarah Archambault edited this conversation with Mahmoud Mamdani. His book is Saviors and Survivors, Darfur, Politics, and the War on Terror. There's a lot to absorb, to reconsider, and to argue about here. Don't hold back. Please post a comment, ask your own question, keep the conversation going at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for joining us.